You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says that he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. And we take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the way stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl and a big old chunk of homemade bread, and help us enrich this reading experience and have some fun too. We've got seven more Brothers Grimm fairy tales for you today. A few may be familiar, a few may not be. We will retell them here if you haven't read them. Joining me as always to tell these stories and talk them over, he's the type of guy who will always be willing to exchange his clothes with you in the woods so you can each go your way in disguise. It's Michael Farmer.
Yeah, except the three drops of blood from my mother will will call out for vengeance.
That's right. If your mother only knew. I almost used that little line, but I couldn't figure out how to work it, like how exactly to phrase it.
I don't think I was familiar with any of the ones we're talking about today. Usually, I feel like we've picked one that I've at least heard of, but I think these were all new to me.
Yeah, we seem to be in a section. I don't know if the adapters only read the first couple hundred pages. we seem to be in the next couple sections. Like, I haven't come across anything familiar. Actually, so there's one in the following section that neither of us chose, the porridge bowl or sweet porridge or something like that, and I was familiar with that story.
Oh, I didn't know that one either.
I was interesting. Or a similar story. But yeah, anyway, neither of us picked it, so it's neither here nor there. But
I don't know anything about how they organized the stories. There must have been some sort of organization, because you see, like, the first two we're going to talk about are back-to-back, or very close to back-to-back, and they have a lot of similar elements. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they must be organized in some way. That way is opaque to me, and I didn't bother doing any kind of research, obviously.
Right, yeah. trespassers, no information. No, but I think you're right. I did read, you know, a couple months ago when we were starting this thing, the Zipes introduction, and it seems like there was, you know, these were published in, you know, it wasn't just one volume initially, right. You know, like they did several different editions of these and stories. And
this 100-page section that we're talking about today is the split between the first volume and the second volume. It comes near the end of the section we read for today.
Okay. So, but you're right. They're, when you're reading them in order, you definitely sense the, okay, now we're in the section about bears. Now we're in the section about
well, there's the three stories right in a row about foxes and wolves.
Yeah.
Of which we'll talk about one of them. Yeah, it's just, I would be interested to know how they organize the book, but not interested enough to take an afternoon and actually find out.
So, dear listener, if you know, you can email us beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. Set us straight.
And look, I'm lazy and stupid, so I'd probably believe almost anything.
Yeah, there you go.
He's not the smartest person in the world. That's what they say about the third son in the first story.
That's right. But, you know, I've noticed that a lot of times the lazy and the stupid, or the simpletons, as they call it, they end up coming out just fine in these stories. So
the meek shall inherit the earth.
That's right. All right. Well, you mentioned the first story. Should we jump into it?
Yeah, it's The Golden Bird. Am I summarizing this or are you? I didn't bother making notes about which one of us was supposed to to do the summaries.
I think it actually works out. If you start with this one, I think it will work out that we can do every other one all the way through, I think.
Good, because that means you have the ridiculous long one.
Well, yeah, because that is the one that I chose, was the ridiculous long one. So, yeah, I think it works out that we can do every other one. If it runs into one where it was I chose it and you didn't, then that's fine. But yeah, so listeners, if you're wondering why we're stumbling over this, it's because Michael and I both chose three of the stories that we're doing today. So
yeah, that's why we're only doing seven. I think we've talked about this process before. We each choose five, and if they overlap, they overlap, and that way maybe the shows won't always be 2 hours long.
That's right. But as I told my mother, who was telling me that we spoke too much, I said, just listen at 1.5 speed, Mom. It's fine.
We should slow down for the people who are listening at 1.5 speed. So the Golden Bird, a complex story. You've got a king who has a garden, and in this garden there is a tree that grows golden apples, and somebody stealing the apples. So he has three sons, and one by one he has them stay up and guard the tree to see if they can find out who's stealing the apples. And the first two sons, who are the smart ones, they both fall asleep. And the third one manages to stay up enough to see a golden bird come and steal the apple. And the bird leaves one of his feathers behind, and he takes the feather to his father, and he says, hey, look, you know, this golden bird is the one stealing your golden apples. And the king is like, well, I'm going to have the golden bird myself then. And so begins this series of quests that the three sons go on. And each of them, as they go out from the castle, runs into a fox who tries to give them advice about what to do. And the big piece of advice is, look, you're going to come on two ends. One of them is going to be brightly lit and people are going to be having a good time there. And the other one's going to be kind of a dump and quiet and maybe even a little scary. And you should go to the quiet one. Do not go to the brightly lit end. And the first two sons basically tell the fox he doesn't know what he's doing. And they get kind of trapped in this merrymaking inn for years, it seems like. But the third brother actually listens to the fox, and so he ends up in this increasingly ridiculous set of quests, because what'll happen is he'll be sent on one quest and the fox will tell him, you can do this and you can do this and you can do this, but don't you dare do this. And every single time he will screw up and do the thing the fox told him not to do, which will end up with him having to do another quest. So like he, for example, when he gets the golden bird, he's supposed to not take the golden bird out of its plain cage and put it in this fancy cage. And he does it because it seems like the right thing to do. And the golden bird goes nuts and wakes up the king. And so he's going to be put to death if he doesn't go and get for the second king the fastest golden horse in the world. And then the same thing happens there, where he makes an error and he ends up having to go on another quest, this time for a beautiful princess, the golden princess. And he even messes that one up. And finally, the fox just does his work for him, more or less. The fox just completes this quest for him. And he says... you can show me gratitude by killing me and cutting off my head and my paws. And the son is reluctant to do that because the fox has been his friend, I suppose. And then he also gives him two pieces of advice. He says, don't buy flesh that's meant for the gallows, and don't sit on the edges of wells. And so then the son runs into his two brothers, who are about to be hanged for being ne'er-do-wells, and he buys their freedom. And then they suggest that they take a break and sit at the edge of this well, which he does. And then they push him in, thinking it'll kill him. So he has ignored the fox's advice twice. The fox comes down, rescues him. They go and make everything straight. And then finally, many years later, the younger son kills the fox, cuts off his head and his hands. And it turns out he was the metamorphosed brother of the princess whom he had rescued and married. So this is a real Shaggy Dog type story. It's called the Golden Bird. The Golden Bird plays almost no role in the story. It's much more about this very wise fox and his relationship with the kind of dunderheaded youngest son.
Yeah, it's funny when they, you're right, it does seem to be mostly about the fox, but we don't know anything about the fox. And then at the very end, he says, you know, no sooner was it done than the fox turned into none other than the brother of the beautiful princess, who was finally released from a magic spell that had been cast over him.
Like, we had no idea. Yeah.
We had no idea the princess even had a brother. It was never mentioned. You know? Okay. That's great.
This is one of the stranger ones. It's one of those that, to me, when I read it, it seems sedimentary, where details have accumulated to this story such that it was probably initially fairly straightforward and involved the younger son bringing that bird back. But as storyteller added to storyteller added to storyteller, eventually you just got all of these ridiculous details until finally you get this very, very finely grained, complex story that doesn't necessarily pay off the way you think it's going to.
Yeah, but I really liked this one. I mean, both of us picked it, and I really liked this one. And I don't know, I agree with you that these stories seem to have this like built-up structure, but on the other hand, like, it all comes in threes, you know, which seems to be like a pattern. So I don't know, maybe the golden apple to the golden horse to the golden princess was always there, because it is, you know, it does come in that pattern of three. So I'm not quite sure about that.
And it reminded me, I can't remember the name of the story we talked about last time, the one, King Thrushbeard. It reminded me of that in the sense that the structure of the story is very New Testament. It's a very Christian structure in the sense that, so what you expect, or what I expected, was that the two older sons, who are these clever evil guys, will get what's coming to them, and they'll the younger son, this guy they think is stupid, will do the right thing because he's humble and willing to listen to the fox. That's what I expected to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not what happens. He screws up way more than the older two brothers do, and the fox just again and again and again comes to him and rescues him. He says at one point, "You don't deserve my assistance, but just go and get some sleep. I'll do the job for you." So you have this like really, really clear presentation of grace, where there's just like nothing this guy does is ever right. And yet the fox will not abandon him. And I think he says that directly too, that I will not abandon you. So it, like King Thrushbeard, it seems to be just structurally Christian in a way that not all of these stories do to me.
Right. I 100% agree with you on that. I wrote down in my notes that it's a real like full obedience isn't required for grace. Like, there is an understanding of, you know, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments type thing in the New Testament. Right. But it's different than the law. Like I don't fully understand all this myself, so I don't want to get too deeply into it. I, you know, like, the law could never redeem, even if you did keep it fully, right? But like, no one could keep it fully is kind of the point. And then, so he can't keep the law, if you want to call it that, or the, you know, the directions from the fox fully. Like, he never can. But I don't know. There's something. I was stuck by that. Also, Michael, like, what is different between him and his brothers?
Right.
Other than the
first time he listens.
Yes,
to him.
He obeys the very first time. The brothers have no interest in even listening to him. You know, they think, what does a fox know? But he does attempt to listen, at least at the very beginning. He takes the narrow path, I guess.
I have that written down too. Like, that it feels very much like that. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction. Like, I think exactly what's going on there.
Yeah,
we actually see that a couple times in some of the ones we're talking about today, where you're given this option between something that looks pleasant and something that looks not pleasant, and the point of the quest is you have to go through the unpleasant one.
Right. What I found very interesting in this one is that he passes that test on the first go round. Like, he goes to the shabby inn instead of the fancy inn. But then that's his failure every time after that, right?
Every single time.
Don't put the bird in the golden cage, leave it in the shabby cage, but he can't. And don't put the golden harness on the horse, you know, keep the shabby harness, but he can't, you know, like, it's like he can't help himself. Like, I don't know. It had a very, Indiana Jones and the, I forget what the, what's the movie? The Temple of, no,
It's The Last Crusade, right?
Last Crusade. Yes, thank you. I feel embarrassed to not know that, but yeah, where Indiana has to find the Holy Grail, and it's not the one that you would expect. You know, the glimmering one. It's the wooden humble chalice. You know, had that kind of feel to me.
And it's a lesson that the third son, the prince, doesn't learn really, but unlike his brothers, he at least wants to learn it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He seems at least he has some interest in doing what the fox tells him to do. And the fox, like, you know, there's no characterization in these stories. It's not really what they're for. They're plot based, not character based. But like you can see how the fox feels sorry for him and kind of loves him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even despite himself.
Right.
Which is it's weird to me. The twist at the end that the fox ends up being the princess's brother, I think undoes kind of some of that, because it's like that the fox is doing this because he needs the younger brother to do something for him, makes it a less pure metaphor or allegory or whatever for grace.
Right. I was
did
wondering,
you feel that way?
Yes, I did. The first time through, especially, I was like, oh, that kind of, you know, spoils the whole thing. I tried to figure out how it could still work. I didn't come up with anything very good. The best I could come up with is like a lot of these, we see the analogy or metaphor in scripture of, you know, Christ is the bridegroom and the church is the bride. And less often we see, you know, Christ is the brother. You do see that in scripture, but I feel like we see it less often in these fairy tales. And so I didn't know if there was something of that, like, you know, in this case, Christ has been the brother all along that's like looking out for, you know, his younger brother, because we're adopted as sons, right? So in some ways, Jesus is our brother as well, right, as our, you know, our bridegroom or whatever. And so I don't know if there was some of that potentially. I don't know. It lost me a little bit with like, what's the symbolism of like cutting off the heads and the hands? Like do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't, and I don't want to go too far down the road where everything is like an allegory for something rather than it just kind of suggests things. But I don't know, that whole part of it rang a little untrue to me, or maybe I'm reading the rest of the story through the wrong lens or something, and that's why maybe it's not really supposed to be about grace.
No, I think it's definitely about grace. I don't think you're reading that part wrong. I think there's sometimes, and I don't mean to make everything an allegory. That's not what I'm attempting to do either. But I do think that like things can have symbolic resonance without it being an allegory. You know, like, sure, it doesn't have to be a one-to-one thing in order for like a symbol to mean something, you know? Like,
well, the head and the hands would be the things that the fox used to help him, because he's giving him this advice and then he goes and digs for him. Right, because when he screws up with the princess, he has to shovel, he has to move a mountain. Boy, you know, it didn't even occur to me until I said that. That is an expression in the New Testament about faith, isn't it?
Yes. Moving mountains. Yeah.
So he doesn't even do that himself. The fox comes and moves the mountain for him.
That's where I think you're dead on the grace thing, because like, you know, faith. Faith, even of a mustard seed, you'll be able to move the mountain, right? It's like, have the tiniest bit of faith, and these things beyond your imagination can happen. Like, but how? You know, like they only happen through grace. Like, because like even to have the faith of a mustard seed requires grace in some ways, you know?
Right, right. So the head and the hands then would be the kind of agents of grace to him. He has to remove them. I don't know. It's that part of the story is just really not where I expected it to go. And the other thing that didn't go where I expected it to go is that, so the reason the fox continues to have mercy on the youngest son is that he feels sorry for him. That's explicitly said in the story. And yet, the two times that we see the youngest son have pity on other people, it ends up being a terrible mistake for him. So he wants to let the golden princess say goodbye to her parents. He doesn't want her to cry. So he does that. He has pity on her. And then that's how he ends up in this terrible position where he has to move the mountain. And then he tries to literally redeem the lives of his brothers. And he is rewarded for this by being pushed down a well. So like the story's attitude toward pity is interesting. It's kind of a pragmatic view of who you should even show mercy to, because sometimes showing mercy to people is going to snap back and bite you.
Really? Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't even think about that, but now that you say it, it's like, oh yeah, that is definitely there. I don't know what to say about it because I didn't think about that. But you're absolutely right. There's a very strange thing in the story about that.
But see, that's why I think of these as kind of sedimentary, because the layers don't always match up with each other. And the beauty of the story, in its way, certainly the distinctiveness of the story, is the way that those layers don't entirely match up. But at the same time, it can be kind of frustrating if what you're trying to do is read them as like a coherent aesthetic object. Because right. I don't think they are. I think because of their roots in folk culture, I don't think they're coherent. And that's their kind of majesty. And it's just something you have to be aware of as you read them.
Yeah. Although I do think there is a sense of, you know, keeping it with the New Testament themes. Like, there is a sense in the New Testament of, like, not throwing your pearls before swine. And, you know, there's that one part where, like, Paul turns somebody over to Satan and stuff. Like, there is a way in which... Like, yes, we are called to be gracious as grace has been shown to us, but we're also like there. I don't know. Again, this is one of those balances I don't have worked out in my own head, so I don't want to say too much about it. But like there is something there where like we aren't called to always have unconditional pity. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's tough, though. I was going to ask you about one more thing. My knowledge of like Greek mythology is mostly through the Percy Jackson series, which I think I've admitted before. So there's a point in the Percy Jackson stories, and I don't even remember what it was because it's been too long since I've read it, but there's like a hotel or a casino type hotel, and they get trapped there because it's like all this like pleasure. And that reminded me of like this inn that they get trapped in. But I didn't know the corollary like that Rick Riordan, when he's writing Percy Jackson, was pulling from. Are you familiar with
that would be? No. Okay. It sounds to me like Pinocchio, like Pleasure Island and Pinocchio.
Oh, very much. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I didn't think about Pinocchio. I should have, being, you know, our history together here discussing all the Disney movies, but I didn't think of Pleasure Island. But you're right.
Greek myths are another thing we might want to consider doing after Grimm's, is maybe we get a copy of Bullfinch's mythology and go through that, because I know the big stories there, but I don't know as many as I should as a teacher of ancient Greek history.
Yeah, sure. Use the podcast as a way to do your work. Is that what you're saying?
That's how I always use the Christian Humanist podcast.
It makes sense to me. I'm on board. All right.
Should we move on to the two brothers?
Yeah, let's move on.
This has got to be the longest story, right?
Yes, I think so. I didn't actually check page number wise, but it's definitely, it's a lot of pages. There's a lot of
pages.
Yeah. Listeners, you can let me know how I did on summarizing. I really tried to do well, so we'll see how it goes. Once upon a time, there were two brothers. One was a rich goldsmith, and the other was a broom maker. And the broom maker also had twin sons. So one day, the broom maker was in the wood, and he kills a golden bird, and he takes it to his brother, the goldsmith. And the goldsmith pays him for it, and then asks his wife to cook the bird, because he knows anyone who eats the heart and liver of this golden bird is going to magically find a gold piece under his pillow in the morning. But while the bird is roasting, the twins come and they eat two pieces that fall off, both the liver and the heart, coincidentally enough. So then the twins start finding gold pieces under their pillows each morning, and this is startling. So the broom maker asks his brother about it, and the goldsmith is jealous and upset that he didn't get the heart and liver for himself. So he lies to his brother and says, "This is happening because your twins are in league with the devil." So the broom maker sadly takes his sons into the woods and leaves them there because he thinks that they're in league with the devil, and so he has to leave them. So while there, they are found by a huntsman who fosters them and teaches them to hunt, and they grow up, and it's time for them to adventure in the world. So they take their leave of their foster father, and he gives them a magical knife. And they can stick this knife in a tree at the crossroad wherever they part, And then if either brother comes back to that crossroads, he will see how his twin is doing, because the knife would either rust or shine bright. It'll rust if the brother is in danger, and it shines bright if the brother is doing well. So they go off to hunt. They come across a series of animals, and all the animals say, "Dear huntsman, if you let me live, two of my young to you I'll give." So at the end of this first adventure, each twin brother has a hare, a fox, a wolf, a bear, and a lion. But they're still starving because they haven't killed anything. And they can't find employment that allows them all to stay together, all these animals and the brothers. So they finally decide they need to separate. They take a vow of brotherly love unto death, and they stick the knife in the tree and they go their own way. So the one brother comes to a town that is totally covered in black and it's in mourning. And he asks the innkeeper what's going on. And the innkeeper says, every year the town has to sacrifice a maiden to a dragon. And now the last maiden in the whole town is the princess of the town, and she's going to be sacrificed tomorrow. So the brother decides he'll kill the dragon and save the town. And so he goes up on the mountain, and at the top is a church with three goblets and a sign that says, whoever drinks these will become the strongest man on earth and can wield the sword that is buried at the threshold. So he drinks the three goblets, digs up the sword. The princess arrives. The prince hides her in the church, kills the dragons with the help of his animals. This dragon had seven heads. He cuts them off, and then he cuts out all the tongues, and he wraps the tongues in an embroidered handkerchief that the princess gives him. And then the princess also takes off her necklace and turns it into collars for all the animals to reward them for their help. But after the fight with the dragon, they're all exhausted and they fall asleep. And meanwhile, there was an evil marshal from the king who had been sent along with the princess. And when he didn't see the dragon fly away, he goes to see what happens, and he finds them all asleep, and he sees the dead dragon nearby. So he cuts off the head of the huntsman and carries the princess down the mountain and claims that he is the one who slayed the dragon, saved the princess, saved the town. So the king gives the princess to the marshal in marriage, and but the princess begs for 1 year and 1 day before the wedding would take place, hoping that the huntsman will reappear. She doesn't know that he's been beheaded because she was sleeping the whole time. So anyway, then the animals wake up. They see their master dead. They send the rabbit or the hare to go get a magical root that can heal anything, and they're able to heal their master. But the huntsman thought the princess didn't love him, and that's why she left. So he leaves wandering again. But then a year later, he happens back into that same town, and this time the town is all in crimson. He asks that same innkeeper what's going on, and he says the town is celebrating the wedding of the princess to the dragon slayer. So the huntsman makes a series of bets with the innkeeper that he can get bread, wine, meat, vegetables, and sweets from the king's table. And each time he sends one of his animals, and each time the princess recognizes the collar that she made and then sends the animal back with whatever the animal asks for. And so this convinces the huntsman that the princess is still actually in love with him. And so finally he bets the innkeeper that he will marry the princess. And then, just as he's making this bet, he's summoned to the castle because the king has seen all these animals coming and going and asks the princess about it. And she tells him he ought to send horses and a carriage to get the master of the animals. So at last, they're all at a feast together, and the seven heads of the dragons are brought forth as trophies, and the huntsman asks where the tongues are, and the marshal can't answer, and then the huntsman takes out the embroidered handkerchief, puts all the tongues back in the dragon mouth, and they're all perfect fit, revealing himself as the true dragon slayer, and the marshal is executed, and the huntsman marries the princess, and he shows generosity to the innkeeper and lets him keep all the winnings from all those bets that he was making. And then the new couple lives happily ever after. You would think this is the end of the story, but we're only about three quarters of the way through. So then the huntsman often goes hunting in the woods. There's a forest nearby that's enchanted, and anyone who goes in doesn't come out. So one day he chases a doe into the enchanted forest. His men don't follow him in, and they return to the castle, and they say the young king has been lost. And meanwhile, in the forest, the young king meets a witch, and she turns him and all his animals to stone and throws them in a ditch, along with many others that have been turned to stone. So around the same time, the twin returns to the knife and sees that his brother's side is rusted. So he travels to go find him, and he arrives at the kingdom, and everyone thinks that he's the young king, and he's miraculously returned from the enchanted forest. And he plays along with this, and at night, when he goes to bed, he lays a double-edged sword between him and the young queen. And finally, he figures out that his brother went into this enchanted wood, so he goes in there himself to try and find out what happened to him. He finds the witch. He knows what to do. He shoots her with silver buttons from his jacket because her magic doesn't work against silver buttons. And then he forces her to free all those she had turned to stone. And then the twins burn the witch, which breaks the enchantment in the forest and opens a clear path back to the castle. So then the twin tells the king, or his twin brother, that he's been impersonating him and even sleeping in his bed, which makes the king really jealous, and he slices his brother's head off. But then he immediately feels guilty, and he says, oh, my brother just traveled all this way and rescued me, you know, from this witch, and instead of having gratitude, I killed him. So he sends his rabbit again to fetch the same magic root, and heals his brother, and that's great. So then they come to the kingdom. They decide to come in at opposite gates, and so they're announced at the same time. To the father king who's there, and he's baffled because the gates are an hour's walk apart, so he doesn't understand how the young king can be entering at the same time. And they come in with all their animals, and he can't tell them apart, and the queen can't tell them apart, but then she remembers the collars, recognizes her husband based on the lion's collar. And so then that night, the queen asks the king why he has been laying the sword between them every evening, and he realizes how faithful his brother has been this whole time. The end.
Another sedimentary story.
For sure. Yeah, this one is one of those where it's definitely got a lot of that, the oral babbling stuff. You know, there's a lot of repetition. So I tried to cut almost all of that out. But like, you know, with the telling where, you know, he's sending each animal, he's making these bets with the innkeeper. Each time he's like, oh, now I got vegetables, I bet I can get meat. Oh, I got, you know, like, and there's always a story about how the animals have to avoid the guards getting in, and how they, you know, how they greet the princess is the same every time. Like, there's a lot of that teller's babble in there that I,
yeah.
So it would be fun to listen to a story like this from a really good storyteller, you know?
I wonder how long the story would take.
This one would take a very long time. I mean, this seems like one that, like, I don't know, you're at the feast and, yeah. You know, like in the minstrel comes in and is playing for the evening.
Right. Yeah. You figure it lasts all evening. Minutes for an hour. Yeah. And you figure that any kind of oral version would probably be longer than this. It would probably have more extraneous detail and stuff like that. I find the end of the story to be, like, really, really moving. That this, ultimately, the title of the story is correct. It's not about the relationship of the one brother with the princess, the queen. It's not about his relationship with his animals. It's not about the dragon. It really is about the two brothers. And what he realizes at the end is his brother, who he, you know, killed in a jealous rage. The same sort of jealous rage that made their uncle send the two of them out into the woods because he couldn't have the magical bird egg or whatever, bird liver.
Mm-hmm.
That his brother has been so faithful to him. I find the way that kind of sneaks up on you, you're thinking, when is this going to be over? Why does this keep going? And then the way that last line sneaks up on you is really, really effective aesthetically and narratively.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I do think that the title, it's a little bit of a fake out, because it opens with once upon a time there were two brothers, and it's this goldsmith and the broommaker, and the twins are almost like incidental at the very beginning, you know?
Right.
Like, it doesn't take long until you get into the twin story. But then you're right, like, it spends so long with the one brother, you almost kind of forget about the other twin, especially with these tales where they often like disappear.
Yeah, they just drop people right? For no reason.
Yeah. And so, there. Yeah, then by the time you get back to the knife and the twin and stuff, you're like, oh, yeah, you know, this is the second brother. You know, this is what was the two brothers. And then you're right. That last line, it does really kind of sneak up on you at the very end. So.
You can imagine it in like music where for whatever reason, I'm thinking of that Beatles song, I Want You, She's So Heavy,
mm-hmm.
Which ends like. If people don't know the song, there's just this like crushingly repetitive heavy metal riff that goes on at the end, and then it just cuts off in the middle of the riff, and that's how the end of the story felt. Like super effective. There wouldn't be a better way to end it than the way they did. And because it does have so many layers that it ends so pointedly in that short sentence, then he realized how faithful his brother had been, is really, really good.
Mm.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I really liked this one. I think it's just a really fun story. I have a whole ton to say about it. I mean, despite how long it is, I don't have a whole ton to say about it, but I do think you're right. Like that faithfulness, that virtue of faithfulness, and coming from an unexpected place in a lot of ways, right? Because you think about stories of twins, and a lot of times, like Jacob and Esau, for example, right? Like there's the usurping happening, there's the trickery and all of that's going on, you know. I feel like there's just something with twins where it's like there's a two-sidedness or something, you know. And so for it to come all the way around to where the brother has been faithful, I think is it's really good.
And he's surrounded by these people who love him and animals who love him, right? But ultimately what he realizes is his brother, who's the only person he took the blood oath with, his brother is the one who's loved him the most.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother, you know, had gone off to make his own way in the world. He wasn't nearly as successful, but he came back to see what had happened to his brother and rushed when he saw that the sword had, or the knife had been rusted or half rusted, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're also right there that, like, I mean, we don't know really what happened to him. The story doesn't imagine how long the story would be if we followed both adventures. But, like, he's obviously not become a king in a kingdom himself with a, you know, with a beautiful bride and all that, you know. So, he could have easily just stepped into that.
Like, yeah, he could have. He could have usurped her.
Yeah, everybody believed that he was already, you know. Like, he doesn't even have to, and his brother has disappeared. And so, yeah, it makes it that much more powerful.
Well, and the fact that he kills him, too, I think, that he goes mad with jealousy and kills his brother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing that magical root exists and that you have a rabbit who can run fast enough to get it.
Yeah, it is good. But you're right. He commits the same sins as the marshal, you know, like the marshal is jealous of, you know, all that he's accomplished as the dragon slayer. And so he beheads him in order to gain all that, you know.
But he commits the same sin that his uncle did. Like the reason this whole thing starts, the reason they get disinherited from their broommaker father is that the uncle is envious that they ate the liver and the heart before he did, totally innocently. They didn't know they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
If he were smarter, and I mean, I get that the point is he's not smart, that his envy has made him unreasonable. What he should have done is found a way to get them to move in with him. He should have adopted them, and then he would have had access to the gold coins.
Right.
But you know, evil doesn't think things out sometimes.
That's right. And that's where we didn't really talk about the foster father, but in the story, that's also very juxtaposed with the foster father who like takes the gold coins in trust while he's like raising them. And then, you know, when they're ready to set out on their adventure, he's like, take as much of this gold as you want. It's yours, you know? But you imagine by that time there's, you know, thousands and thousands of pieces of gold, however long they've been living with him. So.
Right. You figure at least 10 years and there's two of them.
Yeah. So. That's a good story.
Is this our first dragon?
Oh, that's a good question.
There aren't as many dragons in Grimm's as I expected there to be.
Yeah. It may be. It may be our first dragon. There's another dragon.
Way more giants than dragons.
Yes. I think there's another dragon coming. Although I don't think we picked the story with the dragon in it, right? In the next section. I get them confused when I like read ahead and then come back. So
right, yeah, right.
I don't know. You're right. There's less dragons than maybe you'd expect.
Well, let's move on to an even weirder story, although this one is short, and so at least it won't take as long to summarize. This one's called The Twelve Huntsmen. We have a man, and he is in love with this girl, and they're going to get married. But just as they are about to get married, he gets news that his father, who is the king, is dying, and he's been summoned to his deathbed, and the father says, "My dying wish is that you need to marry the person who I want you to marry. It's this other woman. It's not the woman you're with." And so we have this son who was torn between marrying the girl he loves and marrying the girl his father wants him to marry. And he goes with the father. He says, "Yes, dear father, your will shall be done. I will marry this other girl." And he just leaves the other woman, and she is brokenhearted about it. And then she comes up with the world's weirdest plan, which is her dad comes to her. He's also a king, and he sees that she's sad, and he says, tell me what's wrong. I'll do anything you want me to do. And she says, I would like you to get me 11 other women who look exactly like me. And he does. And the 12 of them dress up like huntsmen and go and offer their services to the man she was supposed to marry. And he doesn't recognize them. He doesn't recognize that they're women. In fact, the only person in the entire kingdom who can see that these 12 huntsmen are actually women is a very wise lion who attempts to get the king to test them, to tell if they're actually women. And the tests are foolproof. So here's how you tell if somebody's a man or a woman. You throw dried peas on the ground, and men will just walk across them, but women will slip and slide. Or you fill the room full of spinning wheels. And Josh, I don't need to tell you that women love to spin. And so if a woman sees a spinning wheel, even if she's dressed as a man, she's going to go right over there and start to spin. She just can't help herself. Women be spinning. Unfortunately for the lion, a servant overhears him giving this advice to the king and reports back to the disguised princess. And so she instructs her non-men huntsmen to act like men and don't slip and slide all over the peas. And for God's sake, don't go spinning if you don't have to. And so their identity remains secure, but at the same time, he's still going to marry this other woman. And when the other woman shows up for the marriage, the princess, the disguised princess, is so distraught by this that she passes out. And when she falls to the ground, the king runs over and sees that a ring that he had given her before he went back home is on her finger, and true love prevails. He realizes she's his true bride, and they get married and live happily ever after. And the lion, you'll be glad to know, gets back in good graces with the king.
You are mine and I am yours, and no one in the world can ever change that.
Isn't that sweet?
It is very sweet. It's a very sweet story. I really like this. I think this is another one that both of us picked.
A lot of these stories have this notion of true bride in them, that like, for whatever reason, and it's different in different stories, but somebody is the person they're actually supposed to marry and somebody is a usurper. And that's what you get here. Like the sense is, as soon as he sees this woman, he knows he has to be with her. Which, you know, even in the 19th century would have been fairly unusual for kings. You're pretty much going to marry who your father tells you to because you're trying to create an alliance with another kingdom. Rather than
it's all political allies and stuff. And then there's what's it called? The mistresses on the, there's some like court mistresses or something, you know, and all the. I haven't read many of them, so you can tell me if you've read them, but like my understanding is that, you know, a lot of our romance or those early romances are between, you know, kings and the courtly ladies and not queens and kings and the queens. You know?
Right.
It's just kind of an accepted genre trope.
Well, and in theory, like courtly love is supposed to be chaste. You're supposed to be dedicated to this woman, but you're not supposed to actually have a physical relationship with her in theory.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out that way.
I don't know much about this, but this is
the love marriage, right? This is the love marriage triumphing over over the court marriage. And the thing I find most interesting is this begins with two conflicting loyalties. He's not wrong either way, right? He's not wrong to tell this woman that he's going to marry her because he loves her. He's also not wrong to do what his father tells him to do. Filial piety is a big virtue in these fairy tales. So the idea that like he would upend his life to do what his father tells him to do, there's something admirable in that. Mm-hmm. And yet in this particular situation, that is the weaker bond. The stronger bond is the one that he formed personally with this woman.
Yeah, you're right. There's a real tension there between those two goods, right? Like which is the greater good when both goods are, you know, when it's two good. You're not choosing between good and evil, you know.
Right.
It's not like
one of these women is a witch or something.
Yeah, it's not that way where he's been enchanted or something. He's just, like you said, being loyal to his father and his father's wishes. So
I am very interested in the fact that sex characteristics in this story are very, very rigid and very specific, but they're also totally controllable. I love the idea that a woman, if she sees the spinning wheel, just can't help herself. It's like a smoker if he sees a cigarette.
Yeah.
Just has to go over and spin.
Yeah, they'll be delighted. Women will be delighted. Put 12 spinning wheels in here and the women will be delighted. It's very funny.
No man would ever do that.
No man would ever do that. I wonder what the man.
Apparently, it's true too, because the princess is like, ladies, you got to control yourself when you go in the room with this.
I
don't want to alarm you, but there are going to be spinning wheels in the courtroom tomorrow.
Yeah, that's pretty great. And then the king's. I mean, it's like one of those things where the king is like, "You're wrong. You lied to me. These are definitely not women. They didn't even look at those spinning wheels," you know.
Also, the fact that there's a talking lion who's his top advisor is just never commented on.
Oh, but yeah. I mean, if you had a talking lion. There's a lot of talking animals in these stories.
That's yeah, today especially, we have a lot of animals.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you get an Artemis vibe from the, 12 huntsmen?
Well, except they're not, like, by nature huntsmen, right? It's a disguise. It's something they're putting on to get closer to the king.
Right.
I wonder what her plan ultimately was.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe it was that courtly, chaste sort of love, you know? Like, she just wants to be around him, you know? And this is a way for her to be with him, even though she can't be with him, you know?
What's worse than unrequited love?
Yeah.
Can you remember back that far in your life? Like, all you want to do is be around the person, but being around them is even more painful than not being around them. I feel for this poor woman.
Yeah, I feel for her too. Yep.
All right. Well, our next one is The Three Sons of Fortune. This one seems like a joke to me.
Yeah, I think so. So once upon a time, there's a father who's about to die, and he gives each of his sons a gift. To the first son, he gives him a rooster, and to the second, he gives him a scythe, and to the third, he gives him a cat. And he says, these may not seem like much, but it all depends on how intelligently you use them. So the first son sets out with the rooster, and everywhere he goes, the people already know what a rooster is. But at last, he comes to an island where the people have no idea how to order their time, and they've never seen a rooster. So he shows them how it will crow at 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and 6 o'clock in the morning, and they give him as much gold as a donkey could carry in order to get this rooster. And then the second son sets out with his scythe, and everywhere he goes, people are also already know about it. Until at last he comes to an island that has never seen a scythe. And on this island, they harvest by dragging cannons into a field and shooting the grain.
So it's really wild to think that they have developed cannon technology, but have not yet developed the scythe.
It's awesome. I love this is the funniest part of the joke to me, I think, is that they're out there harvesting with cannons. And it says something like, it was really... I forget what they said.
It was a very uncertain way of doing things.
Yeah, it's a very uncertain way of doing things. So anyway, they're amazed at how he can mow the grain so quietly and quickly. And so they pay him all the gold a horse can carry. And then finally, the third son goes out and sails to an island overrun with mice where no one has ever seen a cat. And they welcome the cat and they pay the son with all the gold a mule can carry. But pretty soon the cat becomes tired and thirsty from all the hunting he's doing, and he cries out, meow, and this frightens all the islanders, and they say they're better off with the mice. And so then they attempt to negotiate with the cat, but it only meows again, and so they bring cannons to the castle, and they set it on fire with a barrage of shots, and the cat just jumps safely out the window while the besiegers level the whole castle to the ground. The end.
And here again, it doesn't end where you might expect it to end, does it?
Yeah. Is this? I couldn't tell if this one is pro-cat or anti-cat.
It's definitely anti-villager.
Anti-villager. Yeah, no, you're right. It doesn't end where you... Because, I mean, you think... Yeah, the third son is going to... You know, I guess in most of these stories, the first two sons fail, and then the third son succeeds, right? I mean, so in this one, the first two succeed, and so maybe you think the third one's going to fail, or maybe you think, I don't know. How did you think the story was going to end, Michael?
I don't know, but I didn't think it was going to end with the villagers being so unaccustomed to cats that when the cat meowed, they blew up their castle. Like, I don't even know how to explain what the joke is here, other than, you know, they're ignorant, and they're ignorant of, like, really foolish things. I don't know, but this is another one where they're not going to be making a cartoon out of it. Actually, you know, they could. I feel like this could have been, like, a Silly Symphonies cartoon or something from the 30s. I feel like they could have done some justice to this one, because it's just so absurd.
Yeah.
There's no moral to it. There's no attempt to, like, be realistic or anything. It's just very, very silly.
Right. This is the one that would, nowadays, when you tried to watch it, it would have that warning on it. Like, these stereotypes are wrong then, and they're wrong now.
All the stereotypes about European peasants are offensive and untrue.
Yeah.
They know what cats are. They don't cut their grain with cans.
With cannonballs.
I'm with you. I love the explanation on the part of the narrator as to why it's not a good idea to try to harvest your wheat with cannons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't try this at home.
Yeah.
It's a very uncertain way of doing things. Some of the cannons would hit targets beyond the grain, while others would shoot off the ears instead of the stems. And at no point, none of these villagers were ever like, hey, maybe there's a more efficient way to get the grain off of the stalks of wheat than shooting it with a cannonball.
Yeah. High risk, high reward.
It's a big night for cannons on the show, though.
That's right.
Two cannons right in a row.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this one is so ridiculous. That's the only reason I chose it, because it was very ridiculous. I will say that it starts, there's something in the beginning about, you know, these people didn't even know how to order their time, where I thought, oh, maybe this is going to be some sort of commentary on something, you know? But then it quickly, like, it's not that. It just falls apart.
No, it's just silly.
It's just silly. There's nothing there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing here about knowledge being power, right? That the way they can get rich is by finding something that other people don't know. But the problem, like, that... their ignorance in that third village is so intense that you don't even know what you could do with them.
Yeah. It's a funny little story. It's interesting that they always end up on an island. So I don't know.
You're gonna go somewhere where people don't have a lot of contact with the outside world.
Right. Some sort of age of exploration or something here, maybe.
Did you picture them, like, sailing across the Atlantic? I assumed these were just, like, islands off the coast of Europe.
Well, that's what I thought too. It's probably just islands off the coast of Europe. But I just mean, like, I wonder if a story like this originates, like, at a time like that or not. I don't know.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Or comes from, like, maybe this is I wonder if this is one of those stories that you find roots of it in, like, you know, the Pacific somewhere, where there's, like, all, you know, like, many, many island countries or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you think about all the stuff during the Columbian Exchange. When I teach the Columbian Exchange, my students are always shocked to find out the things that Europeans didn't have and that Americans didn't have until the Columbian Exchange took place.
Right.
And so, I mean, it must have felt somewhat like they didn't have domesticated cats, for example. I think they did have roosters. I think chickens and llamas were the only domesticated animals in the New World. But, like, there were all sorts of things that Europeans would have had for hundreds of years that the people in the New World wouldn't have had. And then vice versa, there's all sorts of crops they would have grown in the New World that they would never have heard of in Europe. And they would have been like, well, how'd you get by without this? There weren't potatoes or tomatoes in Europe until the Columbian Exchange,
right,
for example. So, like, I didn't think about it, but I mean, maybe there is a kind of like age of exploration quality to the story.
Yeah,
these guys are kind of, I hesitate to call them grifters because they're not taking advantage of people. They're giving them something that they can actually use.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's funny on that Colombian exchange thing, like, because even you think about like the most like traditional like foods from certain places, but like they involve tomatoes. And so you're
the first Italian recipe with tomatoes in it comes from the 18th century, I believe.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing in China. Like there's a couple Chinese dishes that like traditional Chinese dishes, you know, you think of China being, you know, thousands of years old, like the thousands of year old culture, but like they involve tomatoes. So you're like, well, that's, you know, it's not that old. So yeah, it is very interesting.
Or for that matter, the stuff that Europe got because of Marco Polo's contact with China, you know, mm-hmm. eyeglasses, postal service, folding money. I'm trying to think of some other things. Not pasta. Well, sometimes you hear he brought pasta back.
Yeah, pasta seems to be kind of a two-way channel.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of similar dishes all along the Silk Road. I read a book about that a few years ago. It was interesting. So anyway. The wolf and the fox.
Yeah, I guess we could probably tie this into pasta. There's certainly food involved. So the fox lives with the wolf and he really hates him because the wolf is stronger than the fox and can make him do whatever he wants. So the fox is always trying to figure out a way to get the wolf in trouble. And the way he ends up doing it is, it turns out the wolf is a glutton and he can't control his appetite. And so the fox ends up getting the wolf to eat. They break into this farmhouse and they get into the cellar, and the wolf eats so much in the cellar that he gets too fat to slip back through the hole, and the farmer comes and beats him to death with a club. And that is the story of the wolf and the fox. This one feels, maybe it's just because it's animal story, but this one feels much more like an Aesop's fable, which is another thing we'll, I'm sure, end up doing on the show eventually. But like, you know, the original Aesop's fables don't have morals attached. That's something later editors did. But you can just imagine the moral that you would attach to the wolf and the fox. Like this is a moral about not allowing your appetites to control you the way they do to this wolf. He's a total slave to his desires. Whenever he eats, he just wants more to eat. And the fox, who resents him, manages to use that to his advantage to get rid of him.
Yeah.
Although this is one of like three or four stories in a row that are stories about wolves and foxes. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I think it's interesting though. Like, there's a subversive quality to it too, though, because it does call the wolf the master of the fox. Like the fox's greatest desire was to get rid of his master.
Right.
And so like there's this sense, you know, I think especially. You know, we don't feel it as much now, but in the past, like, hierarchy was really important, right?
Like, oh, and we'll definitely get there with the last story today. The last story is all about hierarchy.
Yeah. And even, betraying your master or killing your master or whatever. I mean, that's final ring of hell type judgment.
Yeah. Stuff, yeah. That's true. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is interesting that the fox is, you know, I mean, he's not directly attacking the wolf, but he is setting him up to fail over and over again, you know?
'Cause he knows what he is. He knows what he's going to do in particular situations. And all he's got to do is arrange the situation such that he'll do the thing he does anyway.
Yeah.
Is that called a Batman Gambit? I think that's called a Batman Gambit.
Oh, that's, yeah. It sounds like something Batman would do. So. There's another story about like a king, I think, and his brother is gluttonous, and he arranges it so that he traps his brother in prison by, there's no door on the prison door. It's just too small for the brother to fit through, but he keeps him there by every day. He brings all these, you know, luxurious foods and places them in the room with him. And he knows that he'll never be able to resist them. And so he's, you know, he's basically, you know, he's imprisoned. If he ever could resist the food, he could potentially lose the weight to get out, but he never can, you know.
Is that a Grimm's? I don't know that one.
I don't know where I heard that, but I remember it's a very powerful image, you know, like the open door, but you can't get through it, you know, like, I don't know. There's a really powerful image there, and it just has always stuck with me, but I don't know where I picked that one up from.
What's interesting to me about the fox and the, or the wolf and the fox, I guess, is that the fox also eats a bunch of meat. Like, it's not that he's not a carnivore. It's that he's in control of his appetites. He can keep himself from eating too much. And he even tells the wolf, don't be a glutton, don't eat too much. And the wolf doesn't listen to him.
Yeah. No, you're right. There is a little bit of a sense there, maybe, if you want to add any redeeming quality to the fox. I don't know if we want to or not, but if you do want to, there is a sense that, you know, maybe he wouldn't hate his master so much if his master could control himself. So, like, right. Maybe if his master starts to control himself, then, you know, there it would resolve some of the tension in the relationship, potentially.
It must be hard for someone who has a certain amount of control over himself to be ruled by someone who does not have control over himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's probably very, very true. That's probably a great insight into to the seeds of where a story like this comes from, or where a story like this becomes popular, because people, you know, I'm sure people can relate to that, you know. Yeah, Who among us hasn't had a bad boss at some point?
That's right. This person is exercising power over me. He's forcing me to do whatever he wants me to do. But he can't even control himself. He controls me instead of controlling himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Have I talked on this show about how terrified I was of wolves when I was a kid because of Grimm's fairy tales?
No.
I was sure I was going to be eaten by a wolf.
Yeah, it does seem.
I wonder when the last wild wolf left Georgia.
That's a good question. Yeah, these stories weren't really made for Georgia, huh?
No. they weren't made for the suburbs.
I wonder if that's part of why we've forgotten a lot of them.
I really don't know how many of them I ever knew.
Yeah. When I said we, I didn't mean you and I. I meant, like, as a culture, like, we've forgotten them. Like, they're not really written for... I mean, I do think they have... I wouldn't be doing the podcast if I didn't think they had something to offer still, you know, but like it is true that there's a lot of, you know, stay out of the forest or be, you know, beware of, like we talked about last time, you know, like beware of, you know, cottages in the forest and stuff. And it's like, well, yeah, not really the stuff I'm running into on a daily basis, you know.
I don't know, man. I went for a walk the other day and I came up on this house and it was completely made of candy. And I thought, well, wait a second. That's going to be a trap.
I'm glad you lived to tell the tale.
And so that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been reading these. So. Next up, Brother Lustig.
Yeah, another one that both of us picked. I think, I'm not sure if this one's my favorite or the two brothers is my favorite. I think, you know, the two brothers, we talked about the faithfulness, like kind of sneaking up on you and being really good. But this one, I really like this story. So
it's a really, really weird story. Very, very funny. It's like a story about a lovable rogue.
Yeah.
A trickster. Yeah. Lustig, by the way, is German for funny or amusing.
Okay, I tried to look that up and didn't get as far as you did, so I'm glad you let us know that. So
I didn't look it up. I'm trying to, as I've mentioned several times now, I'm trying to learn German because we're going to go to Germany next year, I hope. And I learned, it came up on Duolingo this week, Lustig.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and I was like, wait a second, that name sounds familiar.
Good job, Duolingo. Duolingo is very sad with me right now. I've got the... I've got the very sad Duolingo icon on my phone at the moment. So...
Well, you can't get through life without letting some people down. It may as well be a cartoon owl.
Yeah, that's right. Duo.
There are worse people to let down.
So once upon a time, there was a great war. And when it was over, the soldiers were discharged with their walking papers. And Brother Lustig received 4 coins and a loaf of bread. And as he went upon his way, St. Peter appeared to him, disguised as a beggar. And Brother Lustig gave him 1 coin and 1/4 of his bread. And this happens 2 more times. So Brother Lustig has then only the final coin and the final 1/4 of his bread. And he spends the coin on a beer and he eats his bread. And after he does that, St. Peter appears to him again. And this time he's disguised as a fellow discharged soldier. And he again asks Brother Lustig for something to eat and drink. And this time Brother Lustig says that they would have to beg together. But St. Peter says he knows how to doctor and he could earn them some money and he would share half with Brother Lustig. Brother Lustig thinks this is a great deal. And so they go off and set off together on some adventures. And soon enough, they come to a sick farmer and his wife. And so Peter heals the man and the farmer and the wife want to pay them. But the more they insist, the more Peter is refusing, and Lustig is poking him and calling him a fool and saying, we need the reward. And so finally they get a lamb out of the deal. But Peter refuses to carry the lamb, and Lustig is happy to carry it. But pretty soon Lustig is tired of carrying the lamb, and he's hungry, so he points out a good spot to stop. And Peter says he doesn't know anything about cooking, and he leaves while Lustig is going to cook the lamb. But Peter tells him not to eat anything until he's returned. But Peter takes a long time coming back, and Lustig doesn't want to wait anymore. So he cuts up the lamb, he finds the heart, and he eats it. And then when Peter returns, he says, oh, I only want the heart, and you can eat the rest. And so Lustig makes a big show of looking for the heart, and then he says, oh, we're such fools looking for this heart. Lambs don't have hearts. Everyone knows that. And Peter says, oh, really? I didn't know that. Lustig says, yeah, everybody knows that. So then they go off again, and Peter causes a stream to block their path. And Lustig wants to make sure that Peter can wade through before he tries, and Peter wades through, and it's no problem. But then when Lustig tries it, it gets up to his neck, and he calls for help. Peter asks him to confess that he ate the heart of the lamb, but Lustig refuses to admit it. And then the water rises to his mouth, and he cries for help again. And once again, Peter asks for a confession, and again, Lustig refuses. But Peter doesn't want him to drown, so he lets the water dissipate, and then he helps Lustig across. So then they arrive at a kingdom where the king's daughter is on the brink of death, and Lustig thinks this is great because this is going to give us a gigantic award if we heal this daughter. So he's trying to hurry to the castle, and the faster he goes, the slower Peter goes, and he's like pushing Peter, and Peter's like dragging his feet. And finally they find out that the daughter has died. So Lustig is really upset about this, and he's, you know, saying Peter shouldn't have been dragging his feet. But Peter says, don't worry, I can also bring people back to life. So they go to the castle, and Peter does this weird ritual where he cuts the girl all into pieces and boils her in a kettle, and he lays out her bones, and then he prays for her 3 times in the name of the Holy Trinity, and then she comes back to life. And then once again, Peter is there trying to refuse all the reward, and Lustig is there like poking him in the side and calling him a fool and saying, take something. And the king can see this is happening, so he fills Peter's knapsack with gold, even though Peter didn't want any reward. So they leave, they come to the forest, and Peter says, let's divide the gold. And he starts doing the dividing, and he's putting it in 3 piles. And Lustig is like, why are you putting it in 3 piles? There's only 2 of us. And Peter says, 1 is for me, and 1 is for you, and 1 is for whoever ate the lamb's heart. And Lustig is like, oh, I ate the lamb's heart. And Peter's like, I thought lambs didn't have hearts. And Lustig's just like, yeah, well, they do, and I ate it. So then they separate at that point, and Lustig quickly squanders all his money. But he comes to another kingdom where, lo and behold, another daughter of another king has just died. So he goes and he attempts to raise her life just as he saw Peter do, but he gets the bones all out of order and he can't do it. And he's like yelling at the bones. And St. Peter shows up and says, what are you doing? You're an idiot. You put the bones in the wrong order. And so he says, I'll help you this time, but you cannot take any reward. And Lustig says, okay. And then Peter raises her to life. But Lustig kind of hints and is cunning, and so he ends up with a knapsack filled with gold again. And so Peter meets him outside the gate of the city, and he's berating him, and he's saying, what kind of man are you? I forbid you from taking anything. But then Lustig just kind of shrugs it off, and Peter says, I'm leaving you for the last time, but I'm going to give your knapsack the power to obtain anything you wish. So Lustig resumes his wandering and his squandering. He uses his knapsack's power to steal a roast goose at one point, and then he comes to an inn that is all full and there's no room to stay, but it's across the road from a haunted castle. And But the innkeeper says, don't try and go there. Anyone who stays there, they never come out again. But Lusig says, I'll take the chance. So he goes inside and he is attacked by 9 demons. And while he's being attacked by these demons, he wishes that they all would go into his knapsack. And thus he frees the castle from this spell. And there's a nobleman who owns the castle and he rewards him and he offers him employment. But Lustig strangely refuses this and decides to move on again. And he takes his bag full of demons to a blacksmith who flattens it all out. That kills 8 of the demons, but the 9th demon escapes and goes back to hell. So Lustig, we're given the idea here that Lustig has many more adventures and there's many more to tell about him, but at last he's ready to head toward heaven. And a hermit tells him about the wide and easy way to hell and the narrow and difficult way to heaven. So he decides to take the easy path to hell. But when he gets there, the surviving demon from the backpack in the haunted castle is at the gate, and he refuses to let him in because he's so afraid of him. So then Lustig turns and goes to heaven, and St. Peter is there at the gate, as you might expect. But St. Peter also doesn't want to let him in. So Lustig says to him, well, I don't want anything of yours. And he gives Peter back the knapsack. But as soon as Peter hangs up the knapsack, Lustig wishes himself into it. And that's how he gets into heaven. And Peter is obliged to let him stay there.
Do you like Brother Lustig?
I do. I really like him. He's really likable. And I think there's like something so relatable about him, like in the sense of, I mean, I don't want to over spiritualize this story because I think it is mostly, like you said, just meant to be like kind of humorous and a joke. But I do think it's similar to that first story where like there's no way to fully obey. Like we're going to fall into the same habitual sins and stuff over and over and over again. And St. Peter is trying so hard to help Brother Lustig to like stay out of these sins. And like it's really like, you know, in the end, I mean, you could call the knapsack. I mean, it's a little tricky in this story because it does seem like Lustig is kind of outsmarting Peter. But like, if you read it in such a way, like you could kind of read it as like, there's a grace that steps in for us, you know, and it's, you know, there's that verse in the Bible about like, you know, the angels are in like wonder of this, like they don't understand how this grace works, you know? And so you almost get this idea, like, you know, St. Peter, like, you know, he might be rolling his eyes at Lustig, but you know, there is grace there that is ultimately our entrance into heaven, even if you tried to go to hell first. I guess I don't know.
Well, I'd have to be a fool, he thought, if I took the narrow and rough.
I don't know. I mean, I don't get your theology from Brother Lustig for sure, but I do think that there is that same, like we talked about in the first one, there's that tension there between Maw and Grace. And this is a very, to me, it's a very grace-filled story in the sense that, you know, Peter is obviously working really hard to get Lustig to change and to grow and to, you know, like he's trying to help him out with that knapsack, like, you know, to stop having to steal and stuff. And he ends up stealing anyway. Like, I don't know. He's a mess, but he does defeat the demons with it also, you know, like, if you view the knapsack as kind of a mode of grace in this story, like in some ways it does defeat the demons. So it keeps him from going to hell, and it gets him literally into heaven. So
the story also begins with like a really foolish act of generosity on his part. He gives away 3/4 of what he has to these beggars.
Right. Yeah. He's not like a terrible person.
No, he's very he's very open-hearted.
Yeah, and even at the end, when he's like squandering, like it says, it's not just that he's squandering, like he's not in that like inn, like the first
he's giving it away.
He's giving his money away, and when he steals the geese, like he steals 2 geese and he gives one of them away. Like he's very generous.
He really is like a Han Solo type.
Yeah, yeah, he's the lovable rogue, you know? Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the, like, save the cat style of writing, but, like, the idea of save the cat is, like, in the very first scene, you have your character do something lovable, and then they can get away with murder because you already love them, because in the first scene they saved a cat from the tree,
right.
You know, and then they can get away with anything. And so then you're on the character journey with them, you know, like that's the idea of the save the cat. And so in this one, like, I mean, yeah, the first thing he does is he meets St. Peter disguised as a beggar three times in a row, and all three times he doesn't refuse him. And you get the feeling that the fourth time he wouldn't refuse him either, but he's already, you know, he's at that point, he literally has nothing to give him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and even when he eats the heart, he first of all, he doesn't know that St. Peter wanted it. And second, he doesn't even mean to eat the whole thing. He just tasted it first, but it tastes so good he eats the whole thing. I would like to try lamb's heart now.
I did not take that from the story, but that's awesome that you did.
It's supposed to be the best part of the lamb.
Yeah, that's what he says. It's supposed to be the best part.
It's what St. Peter wants.
Yeah.
I like the kind of anti-Moses miracle St. Peter performs where instead of parting the seas, he makes the seas rise.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like it. Like, I mean, he's just trying so, like, you know, confession is such a key part to the Christian faith, right? Like, he's just trying to get him to confess. He doesn't actually want to drown him. He's just like, oh, all right, I guess he's not going to confess. So he does it, you know? And then he does, like, eventually, like, get the confession out of him, but it's, like, in a totally underhanded way himself, you know? Like, he splits the gold up into three piles.
Hey, let's be fair, though. St. Peter in the New Testament, kind of himself a lovable rogue.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You definitely see it. So. Yeah, I think you can definitely read this story in such a way that, like, when St. Peter hangs up the knapsack on the inside of heaven, he knows exactly what he's doing. Like, he knows that he's letting loose dig in, you know? But, like, you know.
Whatever gets you there.
Whatever gets you there, exactly. So, yeah, I liked the loose dig story.
Yeah, I like that one, too. Well, we got one more. We got the Goose Girl.
Yeah.
So the Goose Girl is this princess whose father is dead, and she has been betrothed to a prince in a very faraway kingdom. So her mother loads her up with an enormous dowry and puts her on a horse named Falada, a magical talking horse named Falada, and sends her off with this chambermaid to go be married to the prince. Before she does that, she pokes her finger with a pin and gives her a handkerchief with three drops of blood in it and says, this blood will help you when you're in need. And so she takes the handkerchief with her, and they don't get very far on the trip before the chambermaid tells her that she's not going to be her servant. And in fact, she is going to dress up like her and marry the prince herself. And she's able to do this because the princess is so distraught that she drops the handkerchief into a river and it flows away. And so she doesn't have any magical powers anymore. So there's nothing she can do. So when they arrive at the faraway kingdom, the chambermaid is dressed up as the princess and the princess is dressed up as a chambermaid. And the chambermaid tells the king that the princess is just some hanger-on and that she should be made to live with the goose boy, the boy who tends the geese at the castle, while she marries the princess. She also, while all this is going on, has the horse Falada executed and has its head cut off so that the horse won't say anything to anyone. Because remember, it's a magical talking horse. So the princess ends up being the goose girl, and she has to stay with this kind of unpleasant goose boy and take care of things. And he's always trying to play with her hair, and she hates it. And she has the Falada's head mounted and put on a wall. And every day she passes by it and says, "Oh, poor Falada, I see you hanging there." And the head answers, "Dear queen, is that you really there? Oh, if your mother knew, her heart would break in two." Well, this goes on for several days. She keeps fighting with the goose boy who wants to play with her hair, and she magically gets the wind to blow his cap off so that he'll leave her alone until she can finish braiding it. But finally, the king finds out that something's wrong, and she can't tell him exactly what, because the chambermaid made her swear a blood oath that she wouldn't say anything But he kind of overhears her talking to herself and realizes what's going on. And he goes to the chambermaid and says, hey, here's a situation I just found out in my kingdom. Somebody has done this. What should we do to that person? And the chambermaid says, well, she should be stripped completely naked and put into a barrel studded with sharp nails. And then two white horses should be harnessed to the barrel and dragged her through the streets until she's dead. And the king says, okay, that's what we're going to do to you because you're the one who did this. I'm surprised you don't remember doing it since you did it like 3 days ago. And that's what happened. And the goose girl gets to be the true queen of this kingdom. And everybody lived happily ever after except the usurping chambermaid.
There's a lot of this sort of like question and answer thing. Like what should we do?
Yeah.
It comes up quite often. And I feel
it's
like
very Nathan and David, right? Nathan tells David the story about the guy who has all the sheep and steals the one sheep and eats it. And David says, oh, let's rip this guy limb from limb. And Nathan says, you are that guy.
Yeah.
There's that, except that, like in this story, the king does not give it to her in any kind of allegory. Nope. He tells her exactly what she did 3 days ago.
Yeah.
And she doesn't recognize it.
Yeah. This happened, I think, in our first episode in this series. We talked about this. I mean, it was like almost exactly the same thing. It was like the same.
We've seen it four or five times.
Yeah.
You would think people, I mean, the point is, right, that like they've given themselves over so much to their evil that they are no longer capable of rational thought. That's what Virgil tells Dante when they go into hell. You're about to meet people who have lost the good of reason.
Right.
And so, I mean, it makes sense to me that the chambermaid has lost the good of reason. And that's why she's not even able to write. She probably believes her own lies. She probably believes she really is the princess.
Yeah. So she's. No, I think you're right. That does make sense.
This is another story that they are not going to make the movie out of, just because I think this story is very difficult for modern people to understand, because the whole idea is these social hierarchies are natural hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
The reason the princess is the princess and the chambermaid is the chambermaid is because she was born that way, and that's right and just, and it is in fact unjust to want something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bitter pill for modern people, including me, by the way. I'm much more comfortable with the wolf and the fox, where the fox outsmarts his corrupt master and lives happily ever after.
Right. Yeah. Not a lot of social mobility in the in the traditional hierarchies, right?
No. I mean, it reminds me very much of Plato's Republic. Plato's definition of justice in the Republic is everybody does the part in society they've been kind of told to do, fitted by nature to do, and nobody wants anything else. And that's what a just society is. And you see that here, like the natural world itself is upset by the way the chambermaid tries to be the princess.
Yeah.
Everything goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's, I listened to a podcast called The Symbolic World, and he talks a lot about how like our modern world is flattened, and I think he gets that terminology from Charles Taylor, I think, but I'm not positive about that.
I was going to say that sounds like Charles Taylor.
Yeah, I think that's where he gets that from. And so, like, we have such a hard time understanding these hierarchies that was so normal for, you know, most humankind, for most of, human history, right, to understand these hierarchies of things and how, I mean, we talk about it a lot in our Disney episodes with, like, the Fisher King and stuff, you know, like when the top person is, like, injured, it injures the whole, you know, society in some ways, you know, like, that same sort of idea of, like, there's a right order of things, there's a hierarchy to meaning, there's a hierarchy to the structure of the way the world is supposed to be, and there's this hierarchy of like you were born into the position you were meant to be born in, like all of that is it is very difficult for us to get. And I think it's interesting that like we see both. I think the Grimms were writing at a time, I think I mentioned this in one of our earlier episodes, you know, where like that's really, you know, the starting to come to a head, you know.
That's right. Well, yeah, the French Revolution has just taken place, right?
Yeah.
Liberty, equality, fraternity. Liberty,
yeah.
Fraternity, equality. I can't remember the order. But equality is a big goal there.
Yeah.
This is not an equal society, right? Like the princess is better than the chambermaid. And mm-hmm. And she's better. She's morally better. But part of what makes her morally better is the fact that she is comfortable with her position in a way that the chambermaid is not.
Yeah.
And you think back about the number of faithful servants we've seen. Faithful Johannes. Did we talk about faithful Johannes?
I think so. I think that was
That's a story I remember well for whatever reason. I had a student write about it in a paper this year, I think is why I remember it. But faithful Johannes, what makes him a good servant is that he's happy to be a servant. And he takes that lot that's been given to him and he does it to the best of his ability.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I have a hard time not understanding the chambermaid here better than the princess. Like, of course she doesn't want to be the chambermaid. That sounds like an awful life.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. But also, like, it's not just that she's dissatisfied with where she is. She's going to, like, flip the system, you know?
That's right.
Like, I think
she's a revolutionary.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be your servant, which is really something to say when you are, in fact, a servant.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like telling your boss, you're not the boss of me. Well, yeah, I am.
Actually.
You ever say that to your principal?
No, I do not. Yeah. Have you ever read The Tale of Despero?
I have not.
In the Tale of Despero, there's a similar situation to this one where there's an orphan girl who gets brought into the castle, and the rat convinces her that if she just takes the princess captive and dresses as the princess, that she can be the princess, and the princess will have to serve her, you know? And it's in that story, it's completely ridiculous because it's like, well, everybody's going to notice that you're not the princess, you know? In this story, like, it makes more sense because they're going to another kingdom where nobody has seen either of them before, you know? So how would they know who the princess is?
Yeah, but there's, like, no photography or anything.
Right. But as I was reading that, I was just like, oh, yeah, that... I don't know. It highlighted for me the way that in Tale of Despero, exactly what you're saying. Like, it's not just that she's being ridiculous and trying to take over this the princess's position, but it's really this, like, inverting of hierarchy. That's, I mean, it's the problem there, you know.
Yeah. Which I mean. I don't know. I'm glad to live in a society with social mobility. But on the other hand, I think maybe of the three, liberty, fraternity, equality is probably the least spiritual of the virtues. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something to be said for that Platonic definition of justice whereby you have landed somewhere in society and your lot is to accept it to one degree or another. Of course, you could take that too far. You know, there's ways of treating underclasses that are not right. There is such a thing as noblesse oblige and all that stuff. But I don't know. I wonder if our society's kind of hyper fixation on equality has blinded us to some other virtues that are no longer possible to us.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to say it. Like, it's not, is equality right or wrong? It's like, what are you trading when you get to equality? You know?
Well, and
like,
what does equality mean? There's no such thing as a non-hierarchical society. Like, right. that society has never existed and never will exist. There's only societies where the hierarchy is based on something real and when it's where it's, like, spoken or not spoken. We you can pretend we don't have a hierarchy, but we obviously do. Right. Then, I mean, you look at, like, ancient Rome, and, like, it's written into the Roman constitution that there are, I'm trying to remember the phrase they used, nobler people and humbler people, I think is the term. And, like, the rules are different for them. Humbler people can be tortured in police investigations, for example, and nobler people can't. And, like, that's obviously ridiculous. They're, like, equality before the law seems very different than everybody should have exactly the same privileges. But then if you have princesses and chambermaids, do you really have equality before the law? I don't know. I don't have a good read on any of this. I did like this story though, because it was so hierarchical. It's so, like, anti-equality. And because that is a perspective you do not get in contemporary media at all, I was excited to come across it here.
Yeah, I think that's part of the fun of the, you know, breaking bread with the dead or whatever, you know, or the past is a foreign country or whatever. Like, it's right. It's really, it's fun to read these stories, and because it does, it challenges you to think through those things, you know, even if you end up saying, well, I am glad we live in the time period that we live in and not that one, because chances are I would have been the chambermaid.
That's right. Yeah. You're not going to be the king in all likelihood.
Yeah.
But, there's only one of them.
Yeah. But to at least take a moment to, you know, to pause and to think about it and consider, you know, what is lost, or I mean, like you said, like what virtues are now not available to us because of these ideas, you know, because we've taken on this virtue to, and I mean, that kind of, you know, Chesterton talks about like the virtues getting like smashed and then each one becoming kind of its own idol or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there is a sense in which, you know, equality can be a good thing, but if it becomes an idol, then, you know, it's no longer a good thing, right?
Gabriel Marcel says that in a society that's hyper-fixated on equality, you're not capable of admiration, not real admiration, mm-hmm. because all you see is someone who is, you know, the same as you, and you envy them for their higher position, rather than saying, well, maybe the reason they have their higher position is that they have virtues I don't have, and maybe I should emulate those virtues instead of thinking that I deserve what they have. Which I don't know that's an entirely fair way to read demands for equality, but I do think it's worth considering.
Yeah. Well, and I do think where it becomes into the spiritual realm is like when you start thinking of Jesus that way, right? Like,
right.
Oh, he's just another like person like we were, you know, like, yeah, like fully human, but like, don't forget the fully God, and don't forget like, you know, where, how that differentiates him, you know, but like, if you have no room for differentiation, then you have no room for differentiation. Right.
So, right.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I hope your mom is happy. We've talked less than we did last time.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out. Send me an email, Mom. How'd we do?
Shall I read off the list of the 8 stories we're talking about next month?
Yes, please do.
The Gnome, The Water of Life, Bear Skin, The Wren and the Bear, The Two Travelers, Hans My Hedgehog, The Bright Sun Will Bring It to Light, and The Three Army Surgeons. So we'll have a list of those on the in the notes for the episode on your podcatcher. They'll be listed there as well. But I'll read them again just in case you were furiously trying to write them down. The Gnome, The Water of Life, Bear Skin, The Wren and the Bear, The Two Travelers, Hans My Hedgehog, The Bright Sun Will Bring It to Light, and The Three Army Surgeons.
And I will say, I'll probably say this again next month too, but the Wren and the Bear was a pick because my oldest daughter is also reading through these with us, and she really liked that one. So I picked it on her behalf. So, I mean, I also enjoyed it, but it was not a completely unbiased pick, I guess.
I was going to ask you if you'd been reading these to your kids.
No, my oldest daughter, actually, she's read through the whole book already.
Wow.
Yeah, she's voracious in her reading. Yeah, the other ones, I sometimes retell them to them, but, you know, not all of them.
Yeah, there's some you probably don't want to retell.
Yeah.
So. The Jew in the thorn bush might be one to keep away from him.
Yeah. So, but yeah, we do talk about them sometimes. Like, yeah. Anyway, they're fun. They're fun stories. Well, our press liaison is Christian Filipic, and we are on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. You can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player styles to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you'll find some new and old shows to keep you going. Michael and I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on. So thank you for spending the time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman-Schoeffer. May you reign in your kingdom in peace and bliss.